Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Lowe Institute. My name is Anthony Bubalo. I'm the research director here at the Institute. Welcome to our panel discussion today on the Middle East in flux. It's very difficult to describe it as anything other than in flux, but it's been in flux so long that we've got to kind of try and find new metaphors to describe it. It's a real pleasure to be here today with two people that I've known for a long time and who are great experts in this field in Australia, Dr. Sarah Phillips from Sydney University and Dr. Roger Shanahan from the Lowy Institute, but also from lots of other places. To give you a little bit of their bio, Roger is a former army officer and who had operational service with the UN in southern Lebanon, Syria, but also in East Timor and in Beirut during the 2006 war there, and in Afghanistan. He was the former director of the Army's Land Warfare Study Centre and has been posted as a defence attaché to Australian embassies in Riyadh and Abu Dhabi. Associate Professor Shanahan, I should say, has an MA in International Relations and Middle Eastern Studies from the ANU and a PhD in Arab and Islamic Studies from the University of Sydney. Dr. Sarah Phillips lectures in international security and development at the University of Sydney. She's conducted extensive fieldwork in the Middle East and the Horn of Africa, particularly in Yemen, Somaliland, Kenya, Jordan, Pakistan, and Oman, and has also advised numerous government and international development agencies on matters in these countries. Her most recent book is Yemen and the Politics of Permanent Crisis. So please join me in welcoming our guests. The Middle East in flux. A lot of people say today, I want to start off with a kind of a general question. A lot of people say today that the unrest, the instability we're seeing in the region is really unprecedented in at least the region's modern history since World War II. Some even say even before that. Would you agree with that statement? I'll start with you, Roger.
You would agree to it. Yes, but the only other time I probably would say that we come to anything that approaches what we see today is probably the late 1970s and the early 1980s. You know, there'd been an Israeli incursion into South Lebanon in 1978. You know, the 79 Iranian Revolution is really probably the most recent historical event that is still reverberating throughout the region today. Then in 1980 to 1988, we see the Iran-Iraq War. In 1982, we see the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, which pitches Israel against Syria for a period of time. So there were lots of significant events happening in that period. I think there's probably, in terms of complexity, it's more complex the period that we're seeing today, but I think probably, and even more importantly, what we're seeing today is really magnified, and people's identities and their people's engagement with the difficulties are magnified because we're living in the information age. And so all of these things that we're seeing in the region today, while they're probably a little bit more diversified than 30 years ago, they're much more instantaneous to people, and people identify with them to a greater degree. So for those reasons, I would say that the state of flux that we're seeing in the region at the moment probably has more relevance to us today than those events 30 years ago.
Would you also say, I mean, you rightly mentioned that the Middle East is a region that's hardly immune to kind of crises and wars and in domestic conflicts and regional rivalries. I mean, its modern history is certainly full of those. But what's kind of unique about the current situation is it all seems to be happening all at the same time. So it's not just, you know, kind of civil war in Lebanon and Iran-Iraq war. You've got all those things or things on those levels all happening at the same time and to a degree feeding into each other.
Absolutely. And I think part of the issue is we're seeing, as we'll probably talk about later today, we're seeing regional power rivalry being the driving factor behind lots of this. We're seeing religious identity being the driving factor with another range of issues. We're seeing global power competition interposed over the top of that. We're seeing everything happening on all levels, all at the same time, and broadcast all over the world. And not only that, but as we see in Australia, what was 30 years ago something quite remote, the impacts of what we're seeing at the moment is reaching back into Australia and to other parts of the world.
Sarah, would you agree? I mean, obviously you're a lot younger than Roger is. I mean, Roger was around at the end of World War II, so he has a natural advantage in making these kind of judgments. But I mean, would you, in your kind of study of Middle Eastern history, would you see this as the most turbulent time in the region's history, at least since the end of the war?
Well, yeah. I mean, what we've got is this. It's happening in just about every Middle Eastern state that you can look at. You know, that they are all involved to some degree in some sort of, you know, not only political but many of them military conflict. They're either active participants and protagonists, or they're involved in the mediation, or they're supporting proxies, or other militia forces that are seen to somehow be tied to the serving their agendas. That's very different. We haven't seen this level of intensity spread across most of the different countries in the Middle East before. That's new. One of the things, though, that I think is important to keep in mind is that Middle East observers, for the longest time, were trying to understand what the sources of not stability so much as resilience were. So everybody was always asking, on so many levels, socially, politically, even economically, there are many things about the individual countries that suggest that this can't go on forever. And yet, for the longest of whiles, it seemed like it was going to. So we're all asking, what were the sources of underlying resilience that allowed this to occur? And then when it all sort of came together in late 2010, 2011, the threads of this started to unravel simultaneously. And I think if we look at how the region fits together and why it is that we're seeing so many different explosions across the region at the same time, it helps us to understand some of those dynamics that seemed sort of quite opaque, or that were quite opaque in the lead up to, or in the period leading up to 2011. I think that, to touch on something that Roger was saying, is the way in which internal regime security and perceptions of regime security were not so much to do with external threats or perceived external threats, but it was about what was going on inside the country. And so one way of shoring up domestic support was to support other groups that had similar real or perceived agendas in other countries. And now that the sort of, if you like, the genie is out of the bottle in a number of ways, we're seeing this these underlying tensions, these underlying support for groups in other countries really come to the top in ways that we just hadn't seen. You know, people were speculating about the level of cross-border support that existed, and now it's right in our faces, which is something that really is quite new about this.
I want to draw you out a bit more about it, and we'll come to individual cases in a moment, but keeping it at the general level, you know, we at the moment we tend to privilege those things that hit the headlines. So, you know, it's all about how Islamic State is supposedly, you know, reshaping the Middle East, or how Iran's rising power, you know, Iran will be the new hegemon in the region, those kinds of things. There seems to be much less focus on some of those underlying vulnerabilities of the old order, the underlying causes of decay. I mean, what would you privilege? Do you think it's these new forces that are challenging the old order, or was it really the weaknesses of the old order that have now become exposed?
For me, it's more the latter. It's the weaknesses of the old order that had been there. And as I was saying, this was part of the reason that people were asking for so long, why is it that these regimes haven't broken? Why can they bend and bend and bend and not burst? You know, these are issues that have been apparent for a very long time. And in a sense, you know, there needed to be a spark for this to be brought out into the open. But these are structural, societal, political issues that have been bubbling away for decades, really. While you never want to say that something was inevitable, certainly, and we still see it now, something needs to give, because this is very much about societies reordering themselves at a very fundamental level.
So let's go to a couple of the cases, and I'll ask you each on one of them. Let's start with Yemen, where a lot of your expertise is, Sarah. people are very focused today on Iraq and Syria and almost missing the great tragedy that's unfolding in Yemen. Tell us a little bit about that conflict and some of the implications of that for regional security.
Well, I think as far as the broader region is concerned, one of the major issues is how Saudi particularly, and also the Emirates to a lesser extent, is handling this. Just before I go and talk about that side, though, I think we really need to keep in mind just the horrendous humanitarian cost that the conflict is having. Up to 5,000 people have been killed just in the last few months. There's a blockade against the country that is preventing the most basic supplies from reaching ordinary citizens. That aside, geopolitically, this comes down to a very significant degree to how Saudi is able to manage the tremendous military task that it's taken upon itself. Generally, external interventions in Yemen don't end quickly. We don't have too many examples of them, the last one being when the Saudis were involved in Yemen's 62 to 1970 civil war. Obviously, that went on for a very long time. But Saudi is now in a position where it's caught. It has, as it sees it, real and pressing interest in Syria, but also in Yemen at the same time. And the question is, are they going to have to choose between which one they prioritize? Are they going, at the moment they are quite stretched politically, to a lesser extent economically, but certainly politically. And are they going to be able to manage their engagements on both, or are they going to have to decide where they go? Certainly the indications in the conflict in Yemen are that they're not going to be able to get out of this as easily as they thought. It seemed when the campaign began that they thought that they could get in and out within 2 weeks. There's absolutely no way that this is going to end quickly.
Sorry, I should have asked this first. Give us a little bit of background about... So in Yemen was, of course, one of the countries that saw the overthrow of a long-time autocratic regime as a part of the Arab uprisings. It came a little bit later than it did in other countries. That quickly descended into a civil war when Ansar Allah, otherwise known as the Houthis, managed to take the capital Sana'a and drive the government forces down into Aden and out of Aden. The Saudis then have launched this massive military intervention. I mean, what's the main objective of that Saudi intervention?
Well, the Saudi and indeed the UAE line is that this is to head off an existential threat from the Houthi militia, which they see as being supported by Iran, supported to the extent of really being a fifth column and using Yemen and control of Yemen's territory as a way of working their way into Saudi Arabia. The degree to which this is the case is hotly contested. There's been lots of attempts at bringing tangible evidence to this, but very very little of that has been shown to be necessarily truthful. The Saudis, though, the threat from Iran, they seem to really see this as being something that poses an existential threat. But it's not only the idea that you've got a Houthi militia well-armed on its southern border, but also the demonstrative effect. So you've got a Houthi militia, Shia, showing that you can start a revolutionary movement and overthrow an entrenched elite. That is politically extremely threatening. So it's not so much... or it's not necessarily so much that this is that they actually see the involvement of Iran as being what poses the real threat, but I think it's much more of the political threat of seeing that this is possible.
We, the focus of Western attention again is very much on Iraq and Syria, particularly in terms of the rise of Islamic State and the kind of foreign fighters that are going to Iraq and Syria. In many respects, is Yemen, in your view, as dangerous a situation in terms of the kind of links to terrorism, the generation of foreign fighters, the generation of extreme ideas?
Well, Yemen still has the franchise of Al-Qaeda that has been most internationally active. And there's now claims of operations by ISIS within Yemen. And what you're seeing particularly unfolding in Twitter is this very acrimonious exchange between people who identify as al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and people who identify as ISIS, basically calling each other out and saying, you know, you are insufficiently, ideologically on board. One of the real issues in this, though, was that for a very long time, Yemenis have said, and not for nothing, that this phenomena is not Yemeni. You know, this is all just, it's either ideologically driven from abroad, it's driven from Saudi, or it's a product of inter-elite conflict. What you're seeing in the recent bombings in Aden particularly was that this was local Yemeni kids, and this is really surprising people. And you seem to see this cognitive dissonance when people talk about this issue. On the one hand, people will say in Yemen, you know, this is not, we don't have sectarianism in the way that you see it in Iraq. You know, this is not something that is Yemeni. And on the other, they're seeing it as being an existential fight. It's like you can't, they can't, they're holding two very contradictory ideas about the way that this conflict is playing out. So I think in terms of whether or not Yemen can potentially be as dangerous as Iraq and Syria, I think yes, it can. It has brought in, to a lesser degree, it has brought in some foreign elements. But you also have, at the moment, a fairly uncontrolled movement into uncontrolled polarization, and the radicalization that is occurring within Yemen is happening in a way that Yemenis, I think, until very recently had not expected, and that's really dangerous.
One of the things that Sarah touched on in terms of the Yemen conflict, and we'll now take it about broader in our discussion with you, Roger, is this idea of the Saudi-Iranian proxy war, where, you know, the Saudis and the Iranians for a number of years now have been fighting a proxy war in Yemen, to a degree in Bahrain, obviously in Iraq and Syria. Roger will have a paper out this week that looks at this issue in some detail, particularly looks at how Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states are trying to kind of step into what they see as a perceived vacuum as a result of the US, you know, pulling back to some degree its engagement in the region. I mean, what are the consequences of conflicts like Yemen, of this broader proxy war for the region's stability for and forever trying to rebuild a new, more stable order?
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the may not have started out this way, but certainly currently one of the fundamental drivers of conflicts and insecurity in the region is this competition between middle power, Saudi Arabia and Iran for influence in the region. And I think we too tritely subscribe to the theory, or in popular press perhaps, about this Sunni-Shia divide, that it's all about religion. Certainly there are aspects about it which are religiously based, but this is largely that kind of construct that we're all very familiar with about two competing powers for influence. And on the Saudi side, there's a palpable feeling that the US has withdrawn, if not physically, then in policy terms, from the focus it used to have on the region. And no matter what the US says to the Gulf states, that it's still committed to the region, that we do protect your territorial integrity. One of the things that the region believes it needs to do is to take a much greater role in asserting its own authority in the region. And when they say that, they mean asserting its authority against the encroachment of Iranian interests. And I'll deal with Iran in a minute. But what that has meant is that Saudi Arabia has now become the de facto leader of the Sunni Arab world. In the past, Saudi Arabia and Egypt probably shared that. Probably Egypt was a much more assertive and larger militarily and more capable military that took up that role. But it is pardon the French, but more or less a busted flush at the moment. Its internal security problems, its own economic problems, mean that it's not a candidate for leadership of the Sunni Arab world, and it's fallen to Saudi Arabia, who is not used to leading and developing long-term policy approaches to issues. Saudi Arabia's approach has tended to be to deal with a single issue, not worry about the second-order effects of that, use its enormous financial resources to address that issue, and when a subsequent issue or a second-order effect from that first issue arose, then to address that one in sequence without any overarching policy approach to it. And we're seeing that to an extent being played out in Syria, for instance. But in Yemen, we're also seeing overlaid over this internal competition of the new generation of Saudi leaders, the two princes who are vying for authority in the future, and the king's son who's wanting to reassert or assert Saudi superiority and an ability to stand up for itself, and using Yemen as the scene on which it plays that out. Now, as Sarah pointed out, we're now 7 months into the Yemeni campaign, and in terms of building a coalition and executing a plan, there's not a great deal of confidence that the Saudis have an executable and achievable aim at the end of it. On the other hand, we have Iran, which to all intents and purposes, you know, it's four times the size of Saudi Arabia. It's got this economic potential that hasn't been developed, that will be developed, and it's also got both ideologically and historically a sense of itself that it has a place in the region, and that place is as a regional leader. Now, it has a number of difficulties in asserting influence in the region. You know, it's the wrong ethnicity, it's Persian, it's not Arab, it's the wrong religion, it's Shia, it's not Sunni, and it speaks Farsi, it doesn't speak Arabic. That constrains it, which is the reason why you see Iran works in exerting its influence through two ways, through proxies, by the creation of organisations that are loyal to Iran ideologically. And Hezbollah is the best example of that, but we've seen more recently in Iran militia groups of the same ilk and political parties of the same ilk. At the same time, we have allies. So we have groups who oftentimes with a religious identity that is as a minority without any other external protector, who relies on a much greater power to advance its own interests. And that's what we see in Syria under the Assads. They are an ally, they're not a proxy. It's what we see more recently in Yemen with the Houthis. Houthis are not the same kind of Shia as the Iranians, and so they're allies, they're not proxies. So the unfortunate reality is when you have these two regional powers competing for influence in the Saudis and the Iranians, and in the case of the Saudis, they've taken a very zero-sum view of this great game, if you want to call it that. Any advance or perceived advance of Iranian interests has to come at the expense of Saudi interests. So at every step, they have to be blocked. And if that requires you to use proxies without any care about long-term consequences, that is fine, so long as you've blocked increased Iranian influence. So I think while these two powers, regional powers, are playing out this great game, while the US is taking a more hands-off approach at the same time, I think the unfortunate reality is we're going to see a continued extension of this instability until there's some kind of modus vivendi or arrangement between Saudi Arabia and Iran where they both implicitly recognise each other's spheres of influence in the region.
I'll come back to the moment, but I wanted to touch on something. It's a question to both of you, coming off something you mentioned, Roger, and that's that, you know, of course the US is not withdrawing from the Middle East. I mean, you know, the US is still plays a very important role in lots of different ways in the region. But what Obama has signaled is that, look, if the region has security problems, don't always look to us to solve those problems. The region has to play its own role in solving some of those problems. But is it a case of be careful what you wish for? Because, you know, the US has said, all right, well, look, you know, there's problems here, there's problems there, there's problems in Yemen, so we need our allies to step up. So the Saudis have stepped up and they've invaded Yemen, which is hardly conducive to regional stability. So the question to both of you is it very much be careful what you wish for, and you know, how does the US manage a situation where it wants to take less responsibility for regional security, but that means giving more responsibility to regional states that are not necessarily well prepared to execute that responsibility? I'll start with you, Sarah.
Well, yes. I mean, what you've seen in the way that the US and the UK have done with regard to Yemen is they've really just said, Saudi, go ahead. You know, they've been arming the Saudis, and they've really stood back, and they've been very reticent to take any strong stance on the humanitarian catastrophes that have occurred there. And I think that is a desire to, as you say, to pull back, but also to you know, to signal, I guess, to Iran as well that they're willing to pull back, also while the nuclear deal is going through. In a sense, I think this is something that the Middle East and the Middle Eastern regimes need to sort out largely on their own. The problem is, though, if you're going to give political and military cover to that, and the way that that's being carried out by Saudi Arabia, that becomes a problem. But in a broader sense, I do think this is something that Western support can probably have a more damaging impact on than positive. I think that the real difficulty is to try to walk that line in not doing harm, which certainly in the Yemeni case, I think, means not signing off, not supporting publicly Saudi, the use of, you know, all of the cluster bombs, and all of the blockade, all of these other terrible things that are happening in Yemen. I think for the US and the UK, they need to pull back from this.
Roger, I mean, does the Obama administration or indeed the success of the Obama administration need to kind of recalibrate again? You know, maybe not go back to the days of the Bush administration and you know, the invasion of Iraq, but need to do something a bit more than the Obama administration. Otherwise, the region is going to continue to fall victim to the particular policies of regional states.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very difficult policy decision for, I'd say, for the next US administration, and certainly when when I go to the region, you can see the sentiment building up, but particularly probably last time I was there is in the middle of the year, but just the build-up of the animosity, particularly the Gulf states, towards US policy in the region, about this US administration's view of the region, but really more particularly about President Obama's view of the region. They felt there's this sense of abandonment. But when you actually ask them, in what way have you been abandoned, they can't come up with a practical reason in which they have been abandoned. So the US is a bit damned if it does, and it's damned if it doesn't. So while on the one hand they're trying to give more responsibility to the regional states, I think, as Anthony rightly pointed out, these are countries who don't have sophisticated policy planning or military planning capabilities and an ability to carry them out with the kind of achievable aims or even an articulated aim. So we see the kind of situation we have in Yemen. We see the situation that we have in Syria. And as President Obama has pointed out on a number of occasions, his view is the region's problems are so intractable and they're so deeply set that no matter what, the US is incapable of solving those. The other issue is, particularly in a complex scenario as Syria, what was the policy that he was supposed to implement that would have A, circumvented this from happening, or B, prevented it from happening or prevented it from spreading? And I'd say that you couldn't, because he's not in control of all the levers in the Syrian situation, because so many of the regional states are interfering at cross purposes to what would be US policy. So I think To come back to your original question, the region has pretty well written off the current Obama administration. They're just waiting it out. It's going to be very interesting to see whatever the shape of the next US administration. A, do they want to become more involved in assisting the region to sort out its problems? And B, if they do, what form will that take? What could they do that doesn't risk sucking them in bit by bit into this regional power competition between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which I think will define for the next decade the shape of the Middle East?
I want to come to the audience in a moment to give them an opportunity to ask some questions. But before I do, one kind of last question, which looks to the future. Perhaps unsurprisingly, given the current turmoil in the region, you're starting to see, particularly amongst some Western policymakers, a sentimentality for the old order. And you see that in some of the support now that's going towards the Sisi regime in Egypt. And even, you know, even to make it completely absurd, the kind of Donald Trump statements of the last day, that the whole region would have been better off if we just left Saddam and Gaddafi in place, which may well be true. But you can see where the argument is heading. You see it in Syria now where people are saying, well, look, we may just have to live with the Assad regime. Is that the right approach? Can you simply go back to the old order, or is that realistic, or is that unlikely to work, or is it really beyond us anyway? Sarah, I'll start with you.
It's beyond us. But to come back to something that I was saying before about the way that observers had watched the region and thought, you know, it just doesn't make sense. How is it that these regimes are so almost paradoxically stable? I think the short answer to your very difficult question is that something had to give. We can't go back to where things were, but also this was not a stable order. It was stable superficially, but the idea that you could keep papering over the cracks politically, socially, and also economically in these societies, it just doesn't hold water. And something like this, no one can predict the details, of course, but I think something of this order, a major rupture, was on the cards for a very long time.
With or without an invasion of Iraq?
Yes. Yes, with or without an invasion of Iraq. However, I think that many of the worst elements that we're seeing now, you know, such as the rise of ISIS and the extreme animosity of what is now being coloured as a sectarian dispute, I suspect that we wouldn't have that level of intractability. My point is, though, that there were deep political issues that were bubbling under the surface that were eventually somehow going to come to the top. But the invasion of Iraq in 2003 really changed the direction and the colour of a lot of this.
Roger, can we rewind back to the old order?
I don't think we can. I mean, as Sarah's pointed out, the conditions in the region have always been necessary. They just haven't been sufficient up until now. And you could say that's the case
for unrest.
Unrest. And I think you could say that's the case with Saudi Arabia currently. The conditions are necessary, but we don't know what will happen with it. And I also agree with Sarah, it's not a mutual admiration society, but it's that notion that certainly invasion of Iraq has had an impact in unleashing the forces of Islamic State and these, that notion of intolerant sectarianism that's driven this degree of terrorism. But, you know, on the other side of the Middle East, the invasion of Iraq really had nothing to do with the uprisings in Tunisia, which then impacted on Egypt, and the Egyptian situation had nothing to do with the invasion of Iraq. So we'll never know what... That's why we say about the conditions being necessary but not sufficient. We'll never know, and I don't think anybody will ever know, why the spark happened in Tunisia and why that had a domino effect, other than the conditions could have occurred, but that issue just resonated for some reason. So I think we would have seen partially this degree of unrest, but probably not to the degree that we see it now if 2003 hadn't happened.
Right. I'll now take some questions from the audience. Raise your hand, tell us who you are, and wait for the microphone. It's on the front here. And by the way, please ask a question on any part of the Middle East. These guys pretty much cover the entire region. If they can't, if they don't know the answer, they'll make it up.
Or Anthony will answer it.
Jeff Hodgkinson. I just wonder if the panel could comment on the worsening economic situation in the Gulf states, and particularly and also in Saudi Arabia as well, and whether that'll have an impact.
Yeah, we just had a conversation about this yesterday, actually. And yeah, it's having an impact, but each of the different Gulf states have different oil price, a break-even oil price. For the break-even price for their budget. So Saudi Arabia's, for instance, is significantly higher than some of the small Gulf states. So some of the smaller Gulf states, it won't really have much of an impact. Yeah, in places like Qatar, where you've only got 150,000 nationals, it's not an issue. More of an issue in Saudi Arabia, but the feeling certainly amongst the people that I speak to is it the long-term impact is unknown. There have been indications that over the last 6 months there's been a lot of selling of overseas assets from the Saudis, but it's not known whether that's a short-term fix to pay for the costs of the war or whether that's to balance the budgets because of the oil price. I think we're going to have to see, it's obviously hurting the Saudi bottom line. I think we have to see the impact of an extended period of low oil prices, and I think one of the issues, and it's not going to, because of the clunky infrastructure in Iran, once Iran becomes a full capacity oil producer in the years to come, what impact that's going to have on Saudi Arabia. But I just get the sense, based on conversations, I think the future is not as rosy for Saudi Arabia as it has been in the past.
Sarah, is there anything you want to chime in?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's very difficult to have a very clear view into Saudi Arabia's finances, but certainly they seem to be running a deficit that's much higher than they have previously, and the costs of maintaining allies in, or maintaining proxies in Syria, and the ongoing costs of the war in Yemen puts real strains on that. The question is, A, what happens with oil prices, as I said, and how long the war's going to continue for, and that's the great unknown. But if they keep going, that's certainly going to continue to put pressure on Saudi Arabia's bottom line economically, which of course has the carryover effect when you've got the politics and the economy so infused as you do in Saudi Arabia, and that and the other Gulf states, in that so much of the political legitimacy of the regimes are based upon their ability to maintain largesse to a significant portion of society. Once that thread starts to unravel, then things can move very quickly. And that's part of the issue that we saw in Yemen well before 2011. That unraveling due to loss of oil income was really a key driver in the fragmentation that was already underway when the protests started in Tunisia and Egypt. That then sort of, as you were saying, it had this demonstration effect, and people saw that there could be the chance to remove their leadership. Now, whether the same thing is in the future for the Gulf states, you know, we're reading tea leaves, but certainly there's some similarities that you can draw.
Let me chime in with one important point here too, in that, you know, people think of it in terms of, or sometimes people think of it in terms of, well, if the oil price is low, you know, are these states going to suddenly become impoverished and it's going to cause some political problems? It's the wrong way to think about it. It's about expectations. It's about the level you as a Saudi citizen or a Kuwaiti or an Emirati expect your life to be at. And this was actually very common throughout the Arab uprisings. In Egypt, Egypt's economy grew 7 to 8% in the kind of the decade leading up to the Arab uprising. The problem was the kind of the squeeze that was placed on the middle class and their expectations of what life they should be living and what life they were living, and the gap in that expectations that led many of them out onto the streets. So the problem for the Saudis and the Emiratis and the others is it's not going to be just you know, what's the bottom, how many, you know, how long are we going to be running deficits for, how much are we going to deplete our reserves, but it's also going to be managing the expectations of their citizens to the point where they'll be, so, well, look, things are not going to be as comfortable. Oil is not going to be subsidized to the same degree. We may not be able to provide the kind of the same interest-free kind of loans and other, or we may not be able to provide the number of jobs that we once did in the public sector. And it's that management of expectations that's a fundamentally a political a problem of political management, which is going to be the challenge for these states. Next question. Down the front here.
For all its failings, the Australian political system, as I said, is more or less rational. But my view from this distance is that we're sort of projecting rationality on some of the leaders over there, thinking that you can talk to them, whatever. But I don't know, looking at it coldly, all the turmoil that's going on there, I sort of wonder, are they just nuts or are they all just marching to a different drummer that we can never keep in step with?
Roger, are they nuts?
I mean, there's a term called the politics of the personal. So sometimes, you know, in autocratic regimes, policy development and having people argue different policy outcomes and then making the best decision amongst cabinet, which we think would be the best political way, you know, doesn't happen. It's an autocracy. And in some instances, you know, the Turkish policy towards Syria, for instance, is Erdogan's policy towards Syria when he's prime minister and when he was president. And part of that is driven by the fact that he feels personally slighted by President Assad because he sent a delegation very early on when they had good relations with some suggestions for reform measures that Assad could do to assuage concerns. And they were summarily dismissed. But when you summarily dismiss Erdogan's people, that's a slight to Erdogan. Assad has personally insulted King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia.
Late King Abdullah.
The late King Abdullah. And that has driven, not by any means is the only driver, but it is taken into consideration. These are personal affronts that have been done to the leader's autocratic rule of one way, shape or form. And that's why in some instances the complexity of Turkish foreign policy towards Syria or Saudi foreign policy towards Syria doesn't exist much beyond Assad has to go. You know, that's not a policy, a valid policy outcome. That's just an action that you take. But that, so to answer your question, no, they're not crazy. But to some degree, they step to a different drumbeat sometimes because they take actions personally and they formulate some aspects of policy on a personal level.
Sarah, are they nuts?
No, but we've got to keep in mind that we're not dealing with the classic international relations model of the unitary state here. You know, we don't have one state acting in a very predictable and unified way. You've got not only lots of different competing factions within the states, or in the state apparatus, but you've also got very different groups acting often at cross purposes within society that the state has got to try and manage. And so trying to keep all of these balls in the air is very challenging, and you do tend to come up with often apparently contradictory outcomes because of that. But also, as Roger was saying then and earlier as well, the strategic planning can be, you're dealing with crisis, so you tend to deal with very short-term, likely short-term repercussions without necessarily the long-term strategic planning.
My question is, this might be a slightly tricky one, but how do you see the region evolve in the future? Do you still see the same sort of states still existing, or do you see the creation of new states?
My personal view is that I don't think we'll actually see much difference. We'll see, as I said before, a modus vivendi arrived at. You know, some of the Gulf states, for instance, have accepted, while they're very angry with the 2003 invasion of Iraq, for instance, they've accepted that the old Iraq is never coming back. And I haven't sensed any desire for Iraq to be broken up into a federation from outsiders expecting that because it makes it more difficult for people. They've just decided that's moved on and they're going to move on with it. And one of the other reasons is I just don't see there's no appetite for reform in any of the regional states. So for the foreseeable future, we're going to see conflicts, state-on-state conflicts, but also conflicts based on issues of identity will continue to go on, and the artificial states that have been created, you know, for the past century are much more robust than I think people give them credit for. And, you know, Islamic State can show an earthen bund being bulldozed in the middle of the desert and say that's the end of the Sykes-Picot agreement, but it's not the end of the agreement, and I don't think there's any end to the borders that we see anytime soon.
There's that terrible phrase, the end of the Sykes-Picot agreement. Sarah, do you agree? Same borders in 10 years' time?
Pretty likely, yeah. I mean, one of the places where this question is, other than Iraq and Syria, and I agree with what Roger says about that, is in Yemen. You know, there's been a separatist movement that's been ongoing for quite some time, and there's big questions about whether or not the South will break away.
The South was an independent country.
It was an independent country until 1990, yeah. But the question for a lot of people, while there is a strong ideological desire to break away, many are also asking how would we economically survive? And that does become a very pointed issue once the debate gets more advanced. Would these smaller potential states have the means to survive within the international system?
Before Iran nukes Israel, do you think Israel should strike first?
So, which one of you like that question? Which one of you would like to strike first?
We have to give a short answer.
Listen, I don't think either is going to happen. I mean, there was that crazy notion being touted by some that Ahmadinejad was some millenarian that wanted to hasten the end of days, which ignored the fact that Ahmadinejad doesn't have control over that aspect of Iranian policy, and B,
the former Iranian president,
yeah. And B, the whole notion, you know, ideologically, if you've instituted an Islamic revolution to create a state in accordance with the will of God, the last thing you want to do is to end that by lobbying nuclear weapons at somebody else, because you know exactly what is going to come back. So it's that old notion about Iranian foreign policy and their view of a nuclear capability. If you look at Iranian history, and if you look at Iran looking at Israel and looking at Pakistan, if they wanted the ultimate guarantee of Iranian security, they could say, well, possibly we might want nuclear weapons, or at least an ambiguous state of existence, because that's the ultimate shield for the Islamic revolution. People who say, well, they wanted it because they wanted to assert their authority throughout the region, just having a nuclear capability doesn't make you any more influential. Look at Pakistan, it's a nuclear capable state. It's no more influential in the region than it was before it was a nuclear capable state, but it hasn't been invaded or fought a war with India since that time. So I don't think it was ever, it was talked about a lot in the media. I don't think it was ever a rational argument to be had, and I don't think the Israelis necessarily thought that to be the case either, although I know Anthony did disagree with me at one stage on that.
Sarah?
I think also if you look at how long people have been speculating that Iran is within, you know, this far of obtaining a nuclear capacity, we can go back to the early 80s and people have been saying that for this long. So if they've been ostensibly this close for that long, why hasn't it happened yet? Well, there's a whole host of reasons that I think Roger outlined fairly nicely. There's not, the strategic rationale to do this within Iran is just not there.
Let me just ask a follow-on question, because it is a good point. You've got there are two separate issues here. One is surrounding the nuclear deal. One is the question of, does the nuclear deal prevent the Iranians from building a nuclear weapon eventually, whether it's now or in 10 years' time? And is that what states in the region, Israel, some of the Arab Sunni states, is that really what they're worried about? And there's a separate question of what the deal does. It releases Iran of sanctions, it will enrich Iran, it will allow Iran to improve its conventional influence, strengthen its conventional influence in the region. But focusing just so you've got those two different dynamics at play. What do you think, what are the options now for regional states like Israel, like Saudi Arabia, who more or less had to now basically suck it up and accept the deal? The deal's been done. The Israelis have been very vocal in public in opposition to the deal. The Saudis have welcomed the deal, but in private have been fairly vocal in opposition to it. What can these states do now to deal with these two issues, this whole question that they fear that it won't stop Iran from getting a weapon, ultimately, and secondly, they also fear that the lifting of sanctions will now see Iran a much more influential and powerful player in the region.
On the first one, I think the issue of Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon, which they theoretically could start to do in a serious way after a decade, based on the current agreement, if they were that minded. The other issue, I think that's a much less of an issue in reality. I think the form one, will the signing of the agreement make, should the regional states legitimately be concerned about greater Iranian influence in the region? And I'd say yes. And it's how you view national power. And too many people look at the possession of a nuclear weapon as the ultimate expression of national power. Well, it's actually a very constrained view of national power because you can't really use it because as soon as you use it, you have no national power because your country's gone. President Rouhani, so the current Iranian president, saw economic power as a fundamental aspect of national power, and Iran could not be influential in the region unless its economic potential is unleashed. It's got a good education system, it's got a significant middle class, but it's constrained by what it can do at an economic level because of the very tight sanctions regime that have been in place. But I said earlier about the structural constraints on Iranian influence, ethnicity, religion and language. So it can't be everywhere all the time. And people, non-Shia Arabs have a particular view of Persians. You can say that's based on religion, you can say that's based on ethnicity, but it's a particular view. So there are constraining effects on the influence that you can have. But if you're going to maximise it, then you want to do it in commercial terms and become a very large economic player in the region. And I'm not a big advocate of this. As soon as Iran has much more access to much greater funds, they're going to be much more active in the region. You're going to see it interfering through its proxies. Because even during the tightest of the sanctions, the way the Iranian government is able to allocate its funding, it allocated the fund, if it needed to fund a proxy in the region for a particular strategic outcome, it found the money to fund a particular proxy in the region. So it hasn't been constrained in that sense from exerting its nefarious activity in the region. So I don't think having access to more funds is going to have a proliferation of proxy groups. It's already had the proxy groups in the places that it's wanted for quite some time. I think you're going to see greater influence in the region through economic influence more than political influence, because constraints are much less economically than they are politically.
Yeah. But this is symbolic as well. For the Arab states, and particularly Saudi Arabia, seeing Iran becoming a normal state, so not being a pariah state anymore, is threatening because, in part, Iran has been quite effective despite the fact that they are in some ways religiously and linguistically and ethnically at odds with the Sunni Arab world. They've still managed to make big political strides on supporting the Palestinians and sort of speaking to the so-called Arab street. They've been quite effective at also having the idea out there that change is possible, that revolution is possible. If a state like that then becomes into the acceptable community of nations, that's a real symbolic threat to states like Saudi Arabia.
Sorry, in the back.
Afternoon, Roger, Sarah, and Anthony. Just two questions. My name is Audrey Chubinet from New South Wales Police Counterterrorism Command. In relation to Bahrain, I had a question for Roger. That's a country with an interesting demographic with what's happening with Saudi Arabia and Iran right now. If Saudi Arabia is going down economically, what would be likely to happen in Bahrain? And just quickly, in relation to Syria with the proxy groups that we're seeing now, Afghan Shia groups and Indian Shia groups from Iran, is that likely to be a early 80s Lebanon vacuum and turn into an area of power play for the Iranians? Thanks.
Roger?
The first issue with Bahrain, probably the one thing, both of them are fair points. Probably the first thing about Bahrain is quite economically reliant on Saudi Arabia, for those who don't know. It's got a shared oil field that's degrading over time, but the Saudis give Bahrainis preferential treatment over that. There's only 650,000 people in Bahrain, so we're not talking about a massive country. You can prop up the Bahraini regime for a long time, so I don't think it's going to have I don't think any economic woes that Saudi Arabia is going to have is going to have a massive effect on Bahrain, because they'll always find the money to make sure that the social contract is maintained in Bahrain. On the second issue, I think, and this is something that I hope to do a bit more on in the next couple of years, I think the whole notion of the diversity of Shia militias, both in Iraq and in Syria, is an interesting one. And where this will lead to. The one, without going into too much detail, the notion of Shia militia groups is such that, given the nature of the religion, it's much more hierarchical, and so theoretically at least, the militias are more controllable than some Sunni militias, for instance, and in Iraq, as you know, some of them are just extensions of the political party. So if you meet the needs of the political party, you meet the needs of the militia. For some other elements in Iraq, Sistani has been quite specific in the permission, the conditions within which he allowed Shia militias to arm, so long as they worked in support of the Iraqi security forces. So once that need has been met, then theoretically, your religious need to take up arms should be gone. So, I mean, it's an unanswerable question because I think it's still got some time to play, and Iran is our past masters at thinking long-term about proxies that they might need in some conditions in the future. So I think those links will be maintained, but I don't think it's in anybody's best interest and I don't think they will go rogue, for instance, and there's many other mechanisms that there are in existence to maintain a degree of control over them that don't exist amongst Sunni militias.
Got time for one more quick question, just here.
Tony Dowling, retired radiologist. Given the fact that Iran and Syria are an insoluble mess, why don't we just stay out of the place, as Hugh White has said, and not try to get ourselves into it? Or is it a matter of satisfying alliance management, as they call it? In other words, trying to please the Americans, as we always do.
Is this just in relation to Syria?
Syria and Iraq.
Syria, I'd agree with what you with what you said, we've only got 6 aircraft. In the first month, we launched 2 bombs, so there's no operational necessity to do it. And I think that was a peculiarity of Tony Abbott as Prime Minister and just his worldview. And that having been said, it would have given a degree of flexibility on the ground at the operational level for air tasking orders, so you didn't have these 6 aircraft that you couldn't use. So there's probably a practical reason to do it. But in terms of strategic outcomes, got zero influence, so why bother would be my... So I'd agree with you on that one. I wouldn't agree on Iraq. The unfortunate reality is only 4 countries invaded Iraq in 2003, and we were one of them. So there's a moral, whether you like it or not, whether you agreed with the original decision or not, and I didn't, there is a moral obligation in maintaining the integrity of the Iraqi government, because we're partly responsible for the situation that it currently finds itself in. It bears the majority of the responsibility for misgovernance, but we're one of the reasons why Iraq is as it is at the moment. So it's morally beholden on us to provide a degree of assistance to it. And I think what we have contributed is about right. I think we actually got this one right. It's proportionate, it's necessary, and there's a moral reason for us to be there.
Yeah.
I know you're talking particularly about Australia's involvement, but just to broaden it out a little more to Western involvement in the region and the question that is so often asked, you know, this is so intractable, so difficult, we run the risk of making things worse, should we just get out? I would say that the real responsibility, or the way that positive outcomes can happen, is by A, not lending political support to the more nefarious side of things, but offering real humanitarian support. That's something that we can do. Lobbying to end blockades against a civilian population, but also really stepping up and contributing more on the humanitarian side is a positive impact that we can have.
Ladies and gentlemen, unlike the chaos in the Middle East, our session today has to come to an end. It's been a great pleasure to host Roger and Sarah here. Please join me in welcoming in thanking our speakers today.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Sarah.
It was good. And we'll see you all next time.